Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
That is exactly what I needed to hear.
Thank God someone here knows what they're talking about.
That's us. That's right. Gotta love this American ride.
All right, you need to take the time and get the full picture.
Don't get me wrong. I love the ladies. I mean, they rev my engine, but they don't belong in the newsroom. It is Anchor Man, not Anchor Lady.
For sake, kid, keep your voice down. Your father's listening to the radio.
I'm not American.
This is the Annie Fry Show.
Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. Happy Wednesday. It's the middle of the week already. It's actually the end of February. February 24th. Does that seem rapid to you?
Yeah, yes. It does.
Like, if we're 2 months, it's February 24th, so we're 2 months out from Christmas. And 2 months out from now is April 24th. Man, that's like springtime warm weather kind of stuff.
Yes,
baseball,
so weird.
Baseball and all the fun things that come along with that. This is the earliest I've ever said it, but Katie, before you know it, it'll be Christmas again.
No!
She hates it when
Annie,
I do that.
No!
I'm just saying, things move at a rapid pace. And I have to, you know, I'm due in June. What do I have? I haven't looked at this in a while. Ooh, 113 days left.
Ooh.
That's to the actual due date.
You think you're going to go a week before, though, right?
I do. I mean, it's like I'm in negotiations with my OB to, like, how soon can we do this
thing? Yeah.
Which, you get to that point, and you're miserable, and you've been miserable for a long time, and you know, as a mother, that every day that the baby gets to bake in there is a good day for the baby. And you also know, as an experienced mother, that a chunky baby sleeps better. And that last part of the pregnancy is just where they're putting on a little extra chunk. So there is an investment there. But as I've said before, with my third child, we were scheduled to go in and I woke up at 4 a.m. because I couldn't sleep. My husband gets up at about 4:30. We're getting ready to go to the hospital. And all of a sudden he starts throwing up like crazy. And he's got some sort of stomach bug. And I looked at him. I'm like, I can't wait.
This can't be happening.
You need to get it together. And he made it for the delivery. So I went to the hospital by myself and he was like, no, go. Because I was worried that if we postponed, like, how long are you going to be sick?
Mm-hmm.
And if this takes a week, I don't have a week. Mm-hmm. Like, the baby would not have waited a week. So I don't know.
Jared's so good. Jared's like, well.
He is. He made it for like the perfect window of time to be in there. And then the nurse looked at him after the baby was born and was like, what's going on with you? And he's like, I don't feel well. She goes, you're going home right now.
Get
so
out.
She kicked him out and he went home and then he came back the next day and was a little bit better. But yeah,
do you
nonetheless.
Know that you couldn't have waited a week for sure? Like, did you try?
Nope, couldn't do that. Why don't you ask Evelyn that question, right?
I thought you were going to say.
I'll ask Evelyn next time I see
him. I thought you were going to say Adam Schuster.
Yeah, let's ask Adam Schuster.
Let's not, but let's talk to him. He's the Senior Director of Budget and Tax Research at the Illinois Policy Institute. And good grief, talking about Mike Madigan, the Mike Madigan saga gets weirder every day. And I haven't brought this up quite yet on the show today, but he named a replacement for his seat in the House a few days ago. That person has since resigned. 3 days into the seat, and there's some details coming out about that slowly but surely. Regardless, Mike Madigan, even though he has resigned his seat in the House, even though he has stepped down from leading the Democratic Party in the state of Illinois, he's got a pretty paycheck coming his way here, I guess, in perpetuity. Adam, is that how this works with a pension for a former lawmaker?
That's right. He's going to be collecting a taxpayer subsidized pension forever and until the end of his days, as well as receiving very generous, completely taxpayer funded health care throughout his retirement. And because of a special pension perk that was only available to politicians, not available to teachers, state workers, university officials, anybody else, because of a special perk, his pension is going to jump by about $66,000 a year when you're into retirement. And so he'll be getting over $150,000 per year after the first full year.
Nice. Good to be the king, I guess.
Is this a situation, Adam, where if he were to get charged with crimes by the FBI, would that affect this or would it just continue regardless?
Yes, that absolutely would. There is a provision in Illinois law that if you're convicted of a crime arising out of your official duties, right? So it can't be something, you know, you did on your own time unrelated. But if it's related to your duties and you're convicted of it, your pension would be removed. But I think the story here really is that as Madigan leaves office, he's reminding us of both of his dual legacies, right? Which is corruption. And you can see that in the way that he handpicked his successor, who turned out not to be such a great pick. And it's pension debt. And you can see that in the fact that he's going to be such an immense beneficiary of this broken system that he helped create, that if he collects his pension for 17 years, he'll receive nearly $3 million in lifetime benefits after having contributed only $350,000 over his 50-year career.
Is there anywhere in the private sector that a employee can get that kind of a deal? Am I missing something? Like, where do I go to get that type of a sweet deal?
Yeah, absolutely not. Certainly not in the modern workforce. Defined benefit pensions are all but extinct in the private sector. I think something like, I don't want to misquote the statistic, but it's something, you know, single digits, around 5% of private sector workers have access to a defined benefit pension like this. And it's even worse when you see that, you know, Madigan is benefiting from this massive boost in his benefits because of a perk that he helped put in place. And you know, his fingerprints are on virtually every bad pension bill since day one. He was a delegate to the 1970 Constitution that put the current pension clause in place. And if you just go on through the decades, every bill that borrowed money, shorted the pension funds, increased benefits without paying for them, he's, you know, generally a sponsor or a co-sponsor.
So, Adam, we're speaking with Adam Schuster, who, with Illinois Policy, is the Senior Director of Budget and Tax Research. We can talk about the massive problem facing the state of Illinois that is the public pension system. But there has to be a solution. If we're going to talk about the problem, we have to talk about a solution, which we haven't heard a lot of that, other than tax increases from the Democrat leadership in the General Assembly or from the Democrat leadership in the governor's mansion. Is there an alternative to just taxing all of the residents of the state of Illinois until they wise up and move across a border?
Absolutely. And again, I think the reason it's important to talk about Madigan's legacy here is because him leaving office should be a wake-up call, and it should be an opportunity for a new day, for a new way forward, both on ethics. We need, you know, serious ethics reforms, things like banning lawmakers from lobbying, things like fair maps so that people pick the politicians rather than the politicians picking the people. But more than anything, we need a constitutional amendment to unlock pension reform, to undo, you know, the worst legacy that Mike Madigan has left us with. When he came into office, the year before he was elected speaker, rather, Illinois had a AAA credit rating from the ratings agency, the highest rated state in the nation. Now we're the worst rated state, not only in the nation, but in the nation's history. He grew our pension debt, from around $5 billion to, you know, $144 billion. And so we need to undo that legacy. And the way to do that is to amend that constitutional provision that prevents us from doing anything to reform pensions so that we can slow the future growth rate and benefits, which, by the way, could include Madigan's benefits himself.
Adam Schuster is with Illinois Policy. You mentioned, Adam, that this former speaker, Madigan, picked his successor, Chris Welch, and that he's been a bit of a disappointment so far. Why is that from your point of view?
Oh, sorry. I was referring to his actual House seat replacement, the one who resigns today. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, in general, we have a lot of overturn happening in Illinois, and I guess as an Illinois resident, my hope is that even if it's not the ideal change I would like to have, that there's maybe a light at the end of the tunnel. There's a little light breaking through. Do you see hope for change happening at the state level?
I do see immense hope for change, and I think Speaker Welch, while he's very new in his tenure, there's some promising early signs. He did modify the House rules, the rules that Madigan left him, to open up the process a little bit, to give more opportunities for ideas to be debated and heard in the legislature, and to give more power to rank and file lawmakers rather than just in the Speaker's office. On pensions, I can't share too many details, but I can say in the private conversations we're having with Democrats in the legislature, there's a lot of awareness of the problem and a lot of interest in the solution. It's just, they need to take that last step and finally come out and endorse what everybody should know is the right thing to do. And to go back to Annie's question earlier about tax increases, I should have also mentioned tax increases are not a solution to this problem. They cannot be a solution to this problem. Illinois already spends the largest share of its revenue, both at state and local level, on pensions of any other state in the country. But we also have the biggest gap between what it would take to fully pay off those pensions without reform. And I did some calculations, and it would be about an $1,800 a year tax hike with 100% of that dedicated to pensions for 25 years straight just to pay this off without reform. That would ruin our economy, and it would absolutely be political suicide.
Yeah, and you could also just move out of the state and not have to deal with it anymore and continue to, I assume, draw the pension. What is the federal bailout that a lot of folks anticipate that with this Biden administration and with the Democratic Congress that Illinois is going to receive? How is that going to give us a little bit of buffer room throughout the course of the state?
Yeah, so what that aid will do, it'll be about $7.5 billion just for the state, and then when you add up the local money, the total is a little over $13 billion between state and local governments. But it's breathing room, because Illinois was in a deep fiscal crisis. It was a crisis of our own making, despite what some people would have you believe. Illinois had a budget crisis before COVID. COVID made it worse, and it put us in a really bad situation. This money from the federal government is not a blank check. It's not going to solve all of our problems, but it is going to give us some breathing room, because it can partially cover 2 years of our budget deficits. The risk is when that aid expires, we'll be right back where we were or worse off if we don't do something to close our long-term structural deficit in the interim. And what we need to do is get the constitutional amendment on the ballot for pensions, start getting serious about constraining spending in the state budget, attacking the cost drivers, making sure we're spending money smart rather than thinking, the answer to every problem is always just to spend more. And if we do those things, then Illinois has a very bright future, and we can have a much better recovery from COVID-19 and the recession associated with it than we did after the Great Recession in 2008. If we learn the lesson that we can't just keep hiking taxes and keep throwing that money into debt and pensions and expect things to get better.
Yeah, Adam, kind of piggybacking on what Annie asked there, is that why the amount is what it is for the bailouts? I mean, is every state getting a different amount? Is it based on how bad the economy is? Do you know much about this federal bailout?
Yes. Yeah, so the allocation is based on relative unemployment rates as a share of your total workforce. So it's somewhat tied to the population of the state and somewhat tied to economic conditions.
Well, Adam Schuster, we appreciate your time today. We know that you are on top of this, and providing solutions to these problems is what we are interested in as well. So thank you for the time today. I want to encourage people to check out illinoispolicy.org and request an invitation there to the Lincoln Lobby on Facebook. You guys have a great advocacy group there that's keeping a lot of Illinois residents and taxpayers informed on all of these issues, and encourage people to join that as well.
Thanks for your time.
Of course. Adam Schuster, thank you so much. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to speak with the Senior Advisor for Government Relations at the Heritage Foundation. Kids in cages, eh? That's what folks are saying is happening now, just as it was happening in the Trump administration, just as it was happening in the Obama administration. What's the difference in the way this Biden administration has opened these detention centers than what the Trump administration did? And what's the difference between what the Trump administration did and what the Obama administration did? Is it just semantics? Is it just what we call it? Mike Howell will respond to that when we come back. Don't go away.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez posted about a headline that the Biden administration was reopening one of these HHS facilities for migrant children. Her tweet about it said this: "This is not okay, never has been okay, never will be okay, no matter the administration or the party." So I read that tweet to Jen Psaki, who said this:
"We only have a couple of choices. What we are not doing is dividing these kids and separating from their parents at the border, which is what the last administration did, and why President Biden, or then candidate Biden and then candidate Harris, were outspoken at the time about these kids being pulled from their parents. What we are doing is working as quickly as possible to process these kids into these HHS facilities, which have been revamped, which have medical and educational services available, so that we can then transfer them to families."
But we do have sources down at the border who are involved with this who tell us that the facilities these unaccompanied children are being held in right now under the Biden administration are the same kind of facilities that were used during the Trump administration, including one in Donna, Texas, where the children are kept in tents surrounded by chain link fences.
Peter Ducey, you don't say, you don't say. Kids in cages, kids in tents, kids in modular structures with bars on the windows. I guess it's what you call it, because the Biden administration is saying they're absolutely not following the policy of the Trump administration. Let's talk to Mike Howell about it. He's the senior advisor for government relations at the Heritage Foundation. Mike, thank you for coming on the show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What do you think about what you hear Ducey saying there and the question that he asked Jen Psaki? And the most important thing, clearly, that Jen Psaki wants us to know, the American public, is that they're not doing what Trump did. That's the key that we're supposed to take away from her response there.
Well, God bless Peter Ducey. It seems like he's the only one in that room asking tough questions. Makes you wonder how long they're going to really let him stay. But, I mean, it's the nail on the head. I mean, the Biden administration is dealing with the reality of what you have to do. I mean, it was always this kind of moral panic that the left drove about the kids in cages type narrative. But, you know, the solution to it is either you let everyone in or you don't. You have to hold people in places if you don't let them all in. And so that was the false choice that, you know, Democrats wanted to give Donald Trump when he was in charge, is, you know, don't hold anyone, just let them all in. And the Biden administration's realizing they got a huge crisis on their hands. And that's because it's a crisis they made. They basically campaigned on, "We're going to do the opposite of what Trump did and open the borders." Well, guess what? Everyone south of the border heard that, and they're coming. And so now they're facing the reality. And even if you want to transfer these kids as fast as possible into you know, HHS facilities, that's the agency that DHS hands them off to, when they then get placed with these, you know, charities, families, et cetera, well, guess what? You don't just, you know, tell them, "Hey, go find a charity or a family." You got to hold them somewhere to get them to that place. And so it's just the reality. I mean, I think CBP is, you know, doing what they should be doing. They got to stand up these places. They got to hold these kids. But the reality is the kids shouldn't be coming in the first place. These are parents that are sending these children on dangerous journeys, you know, across desert and the cold in the hands of smugglers and sexual abusers and criminals. They shouldn't be in this place in the first place. And so as long as we keep taking kids in and moving them throughout the country, and you're setting them up, they're going to keep sending their kids here. So it's, you know, an unsustainable problem.
Yeah.
Mike Howell is with Heritage Foundation. He's senior advisor for government relations. You know, in that clip, Jen Psaki did make another distinction that I figured I'd ask you about since she was making it. She said that the Biden administration is not separating kids from their families, and the Trump administration was doing that at the border. Is that absolutely the case, or is there a little more nuance to that?
Well, there's a lot more nuance to it. So basically the whole issue with family separation is that there's this judge out in California that oversees what's called this Flores Settlement Agreement. It's this thing that was entered into by, I think, the Clinton administration initially. And it's been modified over the years. And some of the more recent modifications, you know, from the judges basically say you cannot hold a child for more than 20 days. And so what happens then if a parent comes with their child, what do you do with the parent when you have to release the child in 20 days? So if you release the child to keep the parent, you know, there is family separation. And so that's what was happening under the Trump administration. And then ultimately they decided, you know, after the moral panic in the country that, okay, we'll just have to, you know, let them both go. And so that's the Biden administration is just letting everyone go. So, I mean, to the extent that I wouldn't say they're doing family separation policy per se, although every single time you detain an adult, you're by definition separating them from their family. Whether it's you or I going out getting a DUI, we're in jail and away from our kids.
And so to that extent, there is family separation occurring, but it's, you know, their modus operandi is just release everyone as fast as possible into the interior. So, I mean, the only families they're separating are the families of Americans who become victims of illegal alien crime.
We're speaking with Mike Howell, who is the senior advisor for government relations at the Heritage Foundation. I want to talk about just the, because words matter here, clearly. I think campaigns have been won on these specific words. Kids in cages. And, you know, you look at the facilities that they're putting these children in now, and there's definitely been pictures that have been painted in the imaginations of voters all across this country about what they look like during the Trump administration. Then you hear people say, well, ask about when those cages were actually built. And then you find out that the Obama administration is implicated in the whole process. What are these cages, and how are we accommodating the children that come here from across the border? What are we doing as a country to care for them?
Right. So I think the first thing to note is no country is more hospitable, generous, has higher standards for care than the United States. In fact, you know, when a lot of these kids are placed in temporary holding facilities, it's better than any of the conditions in their home countries. It's the first time they'll see a dentist or a doctor, you know, have access to you know, air conditioning, food, all of the basic necessities. Above and beyond, honestly, what you'd encounter if you were locked up in a local jail cell. These are holding facilities designed for children. I was in the Trump administration, you know, when a lot of this was going on. And one of the things that killed me is just a lot of it, frankly, fake news about this issue. I mean, we hosted members of Congress to come down and check out these facilities because, you know, all the rhetoric in the media were these were filthy, unsanitary, terrible places. That's not true. And, you know, we even did as much. We took members to around the facilities and said, look, here's a room where, you know, it's stocked to the brim with toothbrushes and toothpaste, because there was a whole couple days on CNN where all they were talking about is how kids weren't able to brush their teeth. And so we said, hey, guys, come check it out. Here are all the toothbrushes and toothpaste. Like, that is not a problem here. Here are the doctors. Here are the places we have video games for them to play. Here's, you know, the food situation, all the supplies we had. And, you know, that doesn't work because, as you noted, it's a political thing. And, you know, if you showed the members of Congress and all these things, you'd think they would be like, okay, these are places aren't, you know, what they're being said to be on CNN. Nope. They go out and they go on interviews on CNN and say, I saw the facility. It's the worst thing I've ever seen. So, I mean, obviously, at that point in time in the Trump administration where the moral panic was really incited over this, it was just completely removed from fact and reality. You aren't going to see that in the coverage of these facilities now. But the basic issue is this. The left just doesn't want anyone to be detained in immigration proceedings at all because they want everyone to get in the country as fast and quickly as possible, there to be no interruptions in that process. And why do they want to do that? They want to do that because it thinks ultimately it gets them more votes, more dependence on government programs, accelerates a lot of the changes they want to see in this country. So ultimately, they got a hard issue in front of them. Either you go zero detention and you let everyone in and basically cede control of the border, or you have to do some. And right now they're in between a rock and a hard place because they decried the Trump administration for doing any. And so whatever they do, they're going to be massive hypocrites on. But I'm just thankful at least there are some facilities being set up by CBP that recognize that you need to do something.
Yeah.
Mike Hollow is with Heritage Foundation. As Annie said, we hone in on that phrase, kids in cages, because it's been thrown around so much for the last 4 years or so. But my question for you is, in your professional opinion, you know, this is a much, much bigger issue than that one topic, which is associated with the immigration issue at the southern border. Is this issue going to get actually worse, whether they're in cages or they're in tents or they're in modular little buildings? Is this issue going to get worse under a Biden administration that's not enforcing immigration law, or will the things that they're doing right now actually make that issue better?
Well, it's going to get worse for the simple reason that the green light is on and blaring, you know, down to Central America saying, come in, come in, come in. And so the numbers are, we're already seeing massive upticks. There's no crisis coming. We're already in crisis mode here. It's hard to tell because we've been so desensitized over the years to, you know, all these different border surges and issues at the border. It's hard to, you know, put it in proper context. But this one is really bad, and it's getting a lot worse because the largest amnesty, which is the forgiveness of, you know, all consequences and you get to become a citizen and all benefits you'd want in history is about to be given out or at least proposed. And so just the absolute swarm at the border, along with the fact that the Biden administration has ceased cooperation with Central American countries, which, frankly, the Trump administration strong-armed into finally doing something, whether it was
forcing Mexico to, you know, hold people who were applying for asylum there while the claims are being adjudicated. And the reason they did that is because most of the claims are false. And so they're really not doing anything to mitigate the incoming. And so if the incoming continues to increase and you don't have any of these enforcement or security measures or deterrence, of course it's going to get worse. And I don't think that the country has an appetite for full-on open borders and just release everyone into the interior. So that involves some modicum of detention and processing. And we have learned that that is unacceptable to the base on the left, to have any bit of that. There are no facilities that will ever be sufficient for them. I mean, even when, you know, illegal alien children are released into the interior, folks are upset about the, you know, charities and facilities and homes they're placed in after that. And I'm talking about conditions well above of what we have for foster homes for American children in many cases. And so it's really not a solution in sight. If I'm the Biden administration, I don't know how you thread the needle. But between those two things, you either remove every last consequence and release everyone, you know, free of charge into the interior, or you do something. And it's obvious that even the littlest bit of something is too much for the far left.
Mike, you know, when I think about this issue, it's so complicated. There's so much emotion that is involved in immigration and the question of illegal immigration. And that emotion is what gets amplified in the political realm because people want to use that to retain power. But when you look at specifically this issue at the border, people who want to come here, who want the American dream, we have a way for people to attain that. That process exists. And it really comes down to, I think, that the foundation of how you're going to approach what we do with the southern border, how we look at what we are providing, because you made a great defense there about what we actually, how our generosity as a country, when people come here, they break our laws to come here, and then what we do for them when they get here. It all comes down to that attitude of, is America the victim or the victimizer in this instance? And when you have a mentality that is always rooted in America is the bad guy, you know, I hear you saying if you let them come here and you put them in this facility, it's not good enough. And then if you just let them come in and you immediately place them in a house, that house is not good enough. And you said something there that really, really gets to me, is the way that we treat our own American children who are for want, who don't have the things provided to them that these children will have provided for them, or the adults that come across and bring these kids here. I mean, to me, it really all comes down to, is America inherently the good guy or is America inherently the bad guy? And that seems to be many times divided right on the political line.
Yeah, you nailed it. Absolutely. And it makes you really stop and think, then why are they supporting this class of illegal aliens above and beyond their fellow American citizens? And it's in more ways than one, whether it's government programs, legal protections, political, just near the top of their totem pole of, you know, political constituencies. So why? The question is why? Who in their right mind would support non-Americans over Americans, especially if you're a politician representing Americans? And the answer is really unfortunate, and it's extremely political. The answer is because they think that mass amnesty and voting rights expands their voting blocks. Now, I'm not saying every illegal alien, if given the right to vote, will vote, you know, that way. But I'll tell you this, that's what the left thinks, and that's why they're doing this. In the immigration bill Biden rolls out, believe it or not, they want to give amnesty to about 3 to 5 million of the total, 11 to 20 they want to give amnesty, so about a quarter of the total, will be eligible to vote in 2024 for the presidential election. Now, is that a coincidence? I've never heard in my life of a suggestion to truncate the citizenship process just to get as many people in, you know, Texas, Florida, et cetera, you know, eligible to vote. It is all because Kamala Harris thinks it'll help her get elected in 2024, and it'll help them flip, you know, Texas and Florida, you know, blue permanently. And so it's just, you know, Trump was impeached the first go around for allegedly trading national security for political favors in that Ukraine phone call. That's what they allege. Now, I see no functional difference between opening America's borders and trading our national security on such a wide scale for what they think are political votes. It's the ultimate betrayal of the American voters and their duty to protect this country to basically just open our borders because they think it's a political benefit to them. And I think more people need to talk about it in those terms. That's exactly what's happening and why they're doing it.
Mike Heil, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us. We look forward to talking to you again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
of course. He's a senior advisor for government relations at the Heritage Foundation. I mean, it just, we every week have multiple instances of hypocrisy that makes all of us, it's the mass, it's like the great gaslight, and you are looking at the information that's being provided to you, and it's all you want to do is stick your arm out to the side and point at the host of other instances where when the roles were reversed, everything was okay. Or when the roles were reversed, everything was awful, but now it's okay. It can drive you crazy. Always ask why, though. We know pointing out hypocrisy is going to get very exhausting. You're going to exhaust yourself from it, and it's not going to change anything, but we have to get down to the why, and the power struggle is always, always the foundation underneath it. Let's take a quick break. We'll get some more reaction before we turn it over to the DGS. More Annie Fry Show in just a minute. Okay, so if I were to ask you two, Ryan and Katie, if I were to ask you two, and if you're watching us on the Facebook Live or the Annie Fry YouTube channel Live, comment as well. If I were to ask you, what your top concerns are right now for the country. Totally a broad question. Like, when you think about what are the things really facing the United States of America right now that we need to keep our eye on, try to impact for positive change, what kind of things do you come up with?
You want to go first, Katie?
You go first. You can go, Ryan.
Well, then mine are so big. I would say things like the lack of objective truth, that we can't agree on even what is real anymore, to the point where we're changing what 2 and 2 equals. I mean, that kind of stuff, I think, is at the foundation of where I would go. Policy wise, probably that I'm really worried about us financially with all the money that we're spending long term. And
so, like, deficit, that's probably spending.
That's the main one.
Mine is probably culture. It goes along the lines of information and how we're receiving information, kind of what you were highlighting, Ryan. It's culture, and I think how culture affects education in what we're teaching kids in public school, solely based off of your own bias or your own opinion. Those are pretty scary things for me.
Okay, I think those are all great answers. What about things that you hear talked about a lot in campaigns? Both sides of the aisle, you hear a lot of the same topics tend to come back up. Anything there that you're like, yeah, I think that this is a big issue facing our country, and we need to do something collectively about it. Anything come to mind at all?
Yeah, drain the swamp. I think that's the big one that I would like to hear more politicians talking about, just not being in the system.
Gosh, I'd have to think on that one. I'd have to think about that.
So the reason I ask is because I'm going to share this with you. This is a poll that was done, and Kristen Soltis Anderson has shared it. She is, let's see here, I'm going to get her bio if it'll pop up, co-founder of Echelon Insights, author of the Selfie Vote, Florida woman. She does polls. And this was asked of Democrat and leading Democrat voters. Okay. What are they extremely concerned about? The highest thing that they are concerned about? Donald Trump supporters.
Oh my
God.
82% are extremely, very, 82% of voters responded that they are extremely or very concerned about Donald Trump's supporters. And right underneath that, 79% follow that up with white nationalism, 77%, the top three things, 77% said systematic racism. So Donald Trump supporters, number one, white nationalism, number two, and systemic racism, number three. Trump supporters are more of a concern to these voters than white nationalism and systemic racism.
Oh,
unreal.
My gosh.
Unreal. Have these people ever actually had a friend who disagreed with them? I mean, this looks like the ultimate living in a bubble to me.
So the other things that were listed here, and I'm just going to read down. So I've told you the top three: Trump supporters, white nationalism, systemic racism. And then it goes down from there: gun violence, Americans lacking health coverage, domestic terrorism, police brutality, LGBTQ discrimination, sexism, voter suppression, student debt. And sneaking in there at the bottom with 39% of extremely concerned people, capitalism. And I just would be like, well, you're going to solve a lot of these other things the way you think you're going to solve them, and capitalism won't be a problem for you anymore.
No joke. Wow.
So when you wait, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I think I know why you're asking the question, because now seeing this list, we're talking about issues, and I mentioned policy issue, like financially. These are almost all sort of like cultural slash media driven narratives.
They're emotional.
Yeah.
That's what they are. They're emotional. And there's nothing that if you are persuaded to feel a certain way, there's nothing, there's no numbers, which I guess numbers we don't even use anymore. There aren't any numbers who are going to come out that are going to be able to be produced that say, oh, I think we've really, you know, taken care of systemic racism. It's like when we used to talk about global warming, you know, global warming used to be the main thing. They changed it to climate change. You know why? Because you can prove global warming with numbers. Climate change? I mean, the climate changes. It's going to change. I'm not saying that it's not a concern or something that we should be attentive to and that I want scientists to continue to follow. But the idea of climate changing and the most important factor of that, what we can do about it and what our responsibility is to said issue, it turns into a very emotional connection. And it's impossible to win climate change, because if it's drastic changes in the climate, like Texas freezing over, if it's a heat wave going through the North Pole and icebergs breaking off and disseminating, everybody, like the climate change activists, they always win. It always strikes me, like when Barack Obama and Michelle Obama bought that waterfront home. We were just hearing John Kerry said 3 years ago that we had 12 years to figure this out or we're toast. And so another Peter Ducey question to Jen Psaki is like, that leaves us now with 9 years. Is this the timeline that the Biden administration is going on? Well, if it is, then why are we taking private jets places? Why are we building our houses on waterfronts? If it's as big of a concern as you are telling us, folks, that it is, why aren't you afraid of it? Why aren't you doing the obvious things that you're asking, in fact, getting elected to and potentially forcing everybody else to do? Why is it that when you go to, you know, California and they eliminate plastic straws, but now we have a bunch of paper straws? Like, you can do drugs in California, but you can't drink out of a plastic straw. Yeah. And it's a really crazy situation. And which is more of a threat to, you know, if I live in California, to my family, to my ability to raise my kids in a safe environment? I mean, dare I say, on with the plastic straws. They're way better. Anyway, paper straws are gross. I just don't understand how I do understand. It makes me mad. But the practicality, which is a huge difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, when it comes to why we use government, If the Democratic Party consistently gets to harness emotion and then poke the emotional sensitivity buttons whenever they want to invoke a reaction, which they equate with votes, they're going to win every time. And Republicans come in the door, but they're like, but no, look at these numbers, these statistics. I've got graphs for days. I've got, you know, I've got math. And now it's math is racist. Oh,
use math.
Okay. How, I didn't see that coming. And I'm disappointed in myself that I didn't. They're setting up a situation where there's no ground where if you want to use facts and logic and you're saying something in a completely objectively presented way with information that you can win the argument, because if at the end somebody still feels bad or is made to feel bad for believing something specifically, you lose.
And it all goes back to, I mean, that list alone, it all goes back to that divide where being a Democrat is you're the one with empathy, you're the good person, you're trying to make the world a better place. And if you're a Republican, then you're just a nasty Donald Trump supporter.
And you trying to make the world a better place is what matters. Because your concern is in the approved right place. And if you're trying, you know, like when, if you, the kids in cages thing with the Trump administration, the Obama administration, the Biden administration is the perfect example, because the information there is the same. It's just how we present it. The same information is used to victimize people and to show other people that they're the victim. The same facts. They just change the words around and they run with it. And then you get, you know, if you get 10 stories that say one thing and two stories that say the other, you're going to, most people who don't pay the attention that, you probably pay listening to 97.1 or wherever you get your information from, that's really the quantity. It's not quality of coverage. And again, comes back to the media and the way that they get to shape public thought. And they do it because of the way they make you feel, not because of the way they make you think. They don't want you to think. That's the worst thing that can happen.
I guess money ain't no issue to them either because they're good. That student loan debt paid off. They're coasting.
There's big money. There's big money in this type of stuff. You want to talk about the money in climate change? Where these people are flying all over the world in their private jets to tell you how you need to live your life. Meanwhile, China is not budging at all. And we're supposed to save the world. They don't really care about saving the world. It's power. It is every time. Power and money. You're right. DGS coming up next. Don't go away. So beat the
drum with me. This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.